Okay, welcome back to another episode of the Guru Performance We Do Science podcast. This is episode 38, and today I have Dr. Keith Barr. Welcome, Keith.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, so
I'm
extremely grateful to have you donate your time to come and talk to me today, and sort of the topic that I wanted to get into with you was nutrition and the molecular response to strength training. I'll just proceed this conversation because with something which is that most of the listeners will have already heard a variety of other podcasts. I've done one with Lee Breen. I did one obviously with Lee Hamilton, who was a former student of yours, I believe.
He was a very good former student of mine. So
good, yeah. Well, you taught him well. He absolutely rocked that that podcast. And he did mention that you might have slightly different angles. And that's the best thing about science, is there are different points of view to this stuff. And I guess different labs have a different focus. But for us that are the practitioners, and we're the guys that are listening to you or reading your papers and your research, I think it's important to understand that we don't have the definitive understanding of these things, but we do have greater or lesser sort of strengths of knowledge. And coming to people such as yourself that spend so much time researching these areas is a great thing about this podcast. Because face it, not everybody is reading all the journal articles, and unfortunately they're not all in open access and so on. So I'm coming straight to the mountain here. So let's get into this topic of nutrition and the molecular response to strength training. Could you just quickly take us through this sort of relationship of how strength and muscle mass gains with training can actually be improved by optimizing nutrition specifically?
Sure. So the first thing to realize is a lot of our molecular understanding comes from a bias. And the bias is that, and I'm probably the person who put the bias in place more than anybody else, is the idea that the sole goal of resistance exercise is to activate a certain molecular protein complex called mTOR complex 1. Mm-hmm. And it's a bias because that's really not the whole story. We're doing a whole bunch of research right now that shows that that's not the whole story. But as far as understanding how some of the protein or what we're taking in and what we're eating is complementing what we're doing when we do resistance exercise, it's an easy way to get an explanation, whether it's actually or whether it's only part of the explanation. We're still trying to discover that. And a number of other people are trying to discover that as well. But what we know is that from a number of different studies, that there's a really good relationship between the activity of this complex, mTOR complex 1, and the size that your muscle grows after resistance exercise. And the way that this protein is activated is it's activated in two distinct ways. And one is that you're going to move an inhibitor away from it, the mTOR activation site. And the other is you're going to move mTOR to the mTOR activator. And so those two things are two distinct mechanisms, two distinct ways that we can activate this complex mTOR. And downstream of that, we're going to get more protein synthesis. We're going to get all of these measures that we like to see in the human studies. The two ways that we do this, the moving of the inhibitor away from the mTOR activator, that's done either by growth factors. So when we eat and we get insulin, we get a little bit of a flow over. And there's a little bit of insulin has the metabolic effects through its own receptor, and then it's got the anabolic effects through the IGF-1 receptor. That can move the inhibitor away from the mTOR activation site. But resistance exercise can do that completely independently. And when resistance exercise does that, it means that the growth factors have no effect on the pathway. And that's why when you do resistance exercise, it doesn't do you any good to take IGF-1 or insulin or other growth factors at the same time. because they're both trying to move the inhibitor away from this mTOR activation site. And when you do that, either way, the same thing is happening. So if you have, it's basically like you're on a road. The road is coming down to one lane from two lanes. It doesn't matter how fast each individual lane is going. There's going to be a bottleneck, and that bottleneck is moving the inhibitor away. So whether you do it through the resistance exercise, you do it through the growth factors, there's no additional benefit to having growth factors there when you do resistance exercise. So that's the first way that you activate this complex. And the second way is by moving mTOR to its activator. And that moving mTOR to its activator is done, it relies on amino acids to do that. And so amino acids are specifically important in the process of moving mTOR to its activator. Resistance exercise is moving the inhibitor away. The amino acids bring mTOR to the activator. And so when you've got those two different mechanisms, now having the amino acids together with the resistance exercise gives you more activity, because one moves the inhibitor away, the other brings mTOR to the activation site. And now together you get more of an effect than either one individually.
Excellent.
And so when we look at it, and when we look at optimizing nutrition for resistance exercise, what we're trying to do is we're trying to target that mechanism.
I find, well, you know, and I hear guys like you talking about this, and Lee, and you know, I think it's fascinating that we are now moving beyond this idea of simply just the impact of the training stimulus, and also in isolation the impact of what eating can do. And of course we start thinking about things like leucine thresholds and so on, and we can get into a little bit about that together. But there's this idea that the training and the eating is greater than the sum of its parts. And in my recent podcast with Lee, I'd like to think that I coined the term nutrient priming as opposed to nutrient timing. But the timing of this can also potentially have a factor. Is that right?
So that's part of the idea. And so the timing has got an effect largely because basically if you take in amino acids, take in any form of protein, take in any form of food, now you're going to have delivery of those nutrients to wherever they're going to be stored. If you've just done resistance exercise, you're going to have more blood flow going to those muscles than if you haven't done resistance exercise. The way I explain it to my students is that everybody knows that there's this effect of blood flow, and they know that inherently because every Friday when I go to the gym, about 5 o'clock in the afternoon, all the guys are in there lifting weights. They're lifting weights because they know that they're going to get a pump and they're going to look bigger when they go in their t-shirt out to the bar that night. All they're doing is they're delivering blood flow to the muscles that they want to have look impressive. When you do that, now what you've done is you've targeted everything that you've eaten, because there's more blood flow to those muscles, you've targeted what you've eaten to those muscles as well. So all you're doing is you're enriching how much of these protein, how much of these amino acids are getting to the muscle. Now at later time points, when you're eating, you're still going to have more protein synthesis for the next at least 24 hours when you've done some sort of activity. And so that part of it isn't down to the blood flow. It's down to the fact that if you've done your resistance exercise right, you can activate everything and it stays at a slightly higher activation level, so that every time you eat for the next 24 hours, now you're going to get this additional effect of the amino acids. You're going to get more protein synthesis as a result of having done the activity. This is the reason why your swimmers have big lats, your cyclists have big legs and small upper bodies, because they're continuously activating those muscles so that they're continuously getting more protein synthesis every day throughout the 24-hour cycle in the active muscle, not in the unactive muscle. So your cyclists look like a dinosaur with the small upper body and the big legs. Your swimmers look like, you know, some sort of flying machine with huge lats and very little legs and no traps. That phenotype is directly related to the fact that every time they're going to eat after they've trained, whether it's immediately after, whether it's 24 hours later, they're going to get more protein synthesis in those active muscles. And as a result, they're going to start to look like a swimmer, a cyclist, a rower, whatever.
So in this conversation, you know, and when one reads your papers and your work and so on, obviously we're thinking a great deal about mTOR and its relationship to strength gains. There are obviously multiple factors that are involved in this process, and we could be talking about other kinases and various other things, but can you just sort of bring us, let's just focus a little bit in this area first before we go into other areas with this, but why specifically mTOR? Why should we be learning more about mTOR, and why is it that, you know, your research, for example, is focused so much on mTOR specifically?
So the reason why we focus on mTOR is that this is a protein complex that is important to increasing protein synthesis. And as Stu Phillips, Kev Tipton, other people you've had have told you, a lot of what we look at is this balance between synthesis and degradation. We don't want to decrease degradation because muscle quality goes down. So what you want to do is you want to have an increase in protein synthesis to a large degree. And when you have an increase in protein synthesis, that's going to be mediated by only a handful of different things. And one of the things that is continuously seen is that one of the key complexes is this mTOR complex 1. And so we know that because if you do resistance exercise, but you've previously injected yourself with the drug rapamycin, which is the drug that gave mTOR its name and it specifically inhibits mTOR, 6 hours later, when you look at muscle protein synthesis, there's no increase in muscle protein synthesis in the presence of rapamycin, whereas there is normally when you don't have it. There's a lot of animal studies where if you give rapamycin while you do these huge overload stimuli, you don't get an increase in muscle mass, whereas if you don't have it, you get a 70%+ increase in muscle mass. So there's all this data in the literature that says, oh yeah, mTOR is really important. The other thing that's important about mTOR is it's a direct downstream target of leucine. So as you increase leucine, you get a linear increase in mTOR activity. So when we talk about a leucine trigger, the idea is that what leucine is doing is it's turning on mTOR, and you have to get to a threshold to maximally turn on mTOR. Over that threshold, it doesn't matter how much more leucine you get because you can't increase protein synthesis anymore, even though you continue to increase mTOR activity. So those things are the reasons why people look at it. The other thing is that it controls the synthesis of ribosomal proteins. So the ribosomal proteins all have a signal in their messenger RNA, or their ribosomal RNAs, which is only going to allow them to be synthesized when mTOR activity is high. So you get more protein synthesis of ribosomal proteins when mTOR is turned on. So you get more machinery to synthesize protein in the future. It also controls other things that are really, it basically controls initiation and elongation of protein synthesis. But it is not the only thing that does these. It is just the most obvious and the lowest hanging fruit. So it was the thing we discovered first. And so now as people get more and more into this, and we use inhibitors to mTOR, and we see, well, look, even in the presence of an mTOR inhibitor, we're still getting an increase in protein synthesis with resistance exercise. Now we're realizing that there's other very important processes that are active as well.
So previously, with Lee, actually, we did talk a bit about concurrent training, and I know you've co-authored actually the same paper we briefly discussed, but we didn't really get into how concurrent training might impact upon this mTOR situation. Could you sort of give us an idea? Is concurrent training going to have a relevant impact on mTOR, or you know?
So, in animals where you can get a really big increase in some of the metabolic stress, you can do things to block mTOR. In cells, it's very obvious. There are direct mechanisms by which AMP kinase can, in dividing cells that are very metabolically active, so these are tumor cells that are growing in culture, if you activate AMP kinase, you can shut down mTOR. In human muscle, that's very difficult to do. So what you have to do in order to have an effect of, and it's not necessarily that AMP kinase is doing it, because as Lee Hamilton has shown together with a Swedish group, even when you activate AMP kinase, that doesn't turn off mTOR. So there's not a direct, even though you can say, look, in these cells you can do it, that doesn't mean that that's what's happening in muscle, whether it's in rat muscle, whether it's in human muscle. In human muscle, it seems pretty clear that from exercise, from endurance exercise, you're not getting enough of a stimulus to block mTOR. At least when you do it, and it's the first time you've done the exercise, it's early on. Because what we know about concurrent training is you can increase strength and endurance together really well for the first 6 or 7 weeks of training. But then at about 6 or 7 weeks of training, when the exercise intensity is now really high, both the resistance exercise intensity, because you're lifting a heavier weight, you're getting closer to failure, all of those things are really high, plus your endurance exercise is at a very high level and a very high intensity, when you get to that 6 to 7 weeks for somebody who started as sedentary or recreationally active, it takes 6 or 7 weeks to develop this divergence where you see a decrease in the strength gains that you would normally observe. So what that means is that it's not directly something like AMP kinase that could inhibit mTOR, that it's a cumulative effect that's probably due to other things. We have a very good idea of what it's due to, and it's not just a metabolic stress per se. There's other factors that are very important in limiting how much your muscle grows in response to that concurrent training stimulus. And so, really, we've taken a very simplistic viewpoint over the last few years because for us, it looked obvious. Well, in cells, this is how it happens. AMP kinase inhibits mTOR and then shuts it down. But when you go back and you actually look at the concurrent training studies where they show that there's a negative effect of endurance exercise on resistance, that doesn't happen for the first 6 weeks. We can all get off the couch and grow strength and endurance together. It's only when you get out much further along the pathway that you start realizing that those two things diverge. And so there's something more about the load and intensity, the volume and intensity of the endurance exercise has to be at some threshold before you see this negative effect on growth. And it's not necessarily a negative effect on mTOR, it's a negative effect on other aspects of growth.
So thank you for that. So I remember when I was reading about this stuff quite a few years ago, I know that some of the initial thoughts were very much along the lines of the only way to increase mTOR activity would be via growth factors. So for example, IGF-1, which up until recently was super popular, particularly in the nutritional sort of supplement areas, you know, you'd see products with stimulates IGF-1, you know, to get your maximum gains and so on. But this whole idea of insulin status, insulin resistance, and obviously the use of carbohydrates, potentially the glycemic index of carbohydrates. People talk about high glycemic foods post workout to increase the insulin response, that sort of thing. I mean, do you know where does the insulin relationship fit in here? And also as it pertains maybe to things like carbohydrate intake?
Yeah, so essentially, some of the earliest studies way back in the 60s showed that, you know what, if you have a diabetic who is a type 1 diabetic who doesn't produce any insulin at all, they can hypertrophy just fine. Mm. If you have diabetic humans, type 1, type 2, they can hypertrophy just fine. The type 2 diabetics have a different problem because there's a huge metabolic problem associated with the fat that they're carrying, which limits how much they hypertrophy. But a type 1 diabetic can hypertrophy just fine. So that means, that tells us that you don't need insulin in order for this to happen. When you look at Lee Hamilton's paper that really speaks to this, is a beautiful paper where we did resistance exercise, and then we looked at how much insulin signaling you see afterwards. So we also injected insulin, and what you see, one of the molecular signatures of an insulin signaling pathway or an IGF-1 signaling pathway is that when you have insulin or IGF-1, what happens is the receptor recruits a protein called IRS1. That brings a kinase, a lipid kinase called PI3 kinase to the membrane, and that starts the cascade that is fundamentally and absolutely required for insulin or IGF-1 to signal. Okay, we inject insulin, sure enough, you see an association of PI3 kinase with IRS1. There's no doubt about it. You do resistance exercise, you actually see that association go down. And it goes down quite significantly. The reason that it goes down significantly is that resistance exercise is removing the inhibitor of mTOR. mTOR is then becoming active, and when mTOR is active, one of the things that happens when you get insulin or IGF-1, those things turn on mTOR, and then there's feedback inhibition, which means that one of the targets of mTOR, specifically S6 kinase, can phosphorylate IRS1 and prevent the association of PI3 kinase. What this is designed to do is designed to prevent you from getting into a cycle of when you eat, you activate mTOR, and then it doesn't turn itself off. If it doesn't turn itself off, you would get cancers in your muscle because you would have uncontrolled muscle growth. So to prevent that, there's a feedback process, just like your pituitary. Once you have certain hormone levels, those hormones feed back on the pituitary. Within your muscle, that system through S6 kinase feeds back, phosphorylates IRS1, and you don't get PI3 kinase recruited. Because of that, if you have a high amount of insulin after you've done resistance exercise, there's lots of feedback inhibition, at least for the first 6 hours. There's absolutely no effect because insulin can't recruit IRS1 and PI3 kinase to the membrane, and as a result, it can't signal to mTOR, and it can't do the anabolic things that insulin are supposed to do. It can still do some of the metabolic stuff that it does, but it's not doing the anabolic things that it's designed to do. So there's absolutely no benefit to taking insulin or IGF-1 or taking high carbohydrate, low glycemic index, any of the carbohydrates that are designed to bring up insulin levels. Those aren't going to have any positive effect on the synthesis aspect of things. They might have an effect on the degradation aspects of things, but whether it's good or not to inhibit degradation is still quite controversial.
Yeah, and it's amazing though how far people have taken the small bits of science that haven't yet been conclusive and obviously generated a whole bunch of products and unnecessary calories and all kinds of other things. But moving our eyes away then from that side, let's go back to the training stress then. Lots of people talk about, well, lots of people argue about whether or not it's important just to exert a certain level of mechanical stress, not necessarily to failure. But some people argue that you do need to take it to failure. And I believe that you have an opinion based on your research that you can present to us on that.
Yeah, so the idea of the training load and how much training you need to do or how many sets you need to do or all of those things, again, this is massively controversial. If you look back on the whole research of the sets and the physiological response and the muscle growth and the strength improvement with 1, 2, 3, up to 5 sets, there's only one paper that claims that there's a difference between doing 3 sets, doing 5 sets, or doing 1 set. And that's an early paper by Berger. And if you go back and you look at the data, his conclusions say 3 sets are better than 1. But if you look at the data, there's absolutely no difference between 3 sets and 1 set or 5 sets. And so, you know, some people have challenged him on this, and his comeback was that, well, you know, if I had said that 3 sets, 1 set was as good as 3, all of these practitioners would have come at me and said that I was wrong. Well, that's not science. That's just cowardice. If you go back and you look, people who really believe that 3 sets are better, Stu Phillips believes that three sets are better than one. He published a really nice study where he showed, sure enough, you get a little bit more hypertrophy, but that's because it was a relatively short study. Strength gains were exactly the same whether you did three sets at 80% or one set at 80%. So what we're learning is that it's not important necessarily what your volume is, what the volume of load is. It looks like what's important is that you apply a load and that you apply that load to failure. If you're only looking for muscle growth, you can do it at 30%, 40%, whatever. Bodybuilders traditionally have done this where they lift a lightweight lots of times, they get to failure, muscle still grows nicely. What you want is if you want to grow strength rather than muscle size. So if you want to grow both size and strength together, now what you have to do is you have to lift a heavier weight to failure. If you are doing an exercise that you can get to failure, then one set's enough. So if you're doing an exercise in a machine and you can do, say, a leg press, and you can get all the way to momentary muscular failure where you can't press the weight up, and even you can't resist the weight in the negative direction, that's what we call momentary muscular failure. One set is going to be sufficient to activate all of the hypertrophic stimuli. If you're doing a different exercise, like you're doing a snatch or you're doing a squat or a clean, where because of the small muscles that you need to have active in order to complete the exercise, there's no way that you can get your big muscles to failure. Now what you have to do is you have to add subsequent sets because one set, you can't get close to failure. You can only produce the motion and then the small muscles of your back or the small muscles of your grip are going to fail. So you need to come back with another set and another set and another set until you get closer and closer to failure. We know that because if you do, like I said, the 30%, so you do a lower weight and you do it to failure, you get a hypertrophic stimulus. We know that because if you do blood flow restriction and you do a resistance exercise, you get closer to failure. So the reason for this, the reason that there is this distinction is because in humans, we don't recruit all of the muscle fibers within our muscle, except when we get to failure. So when you're not at failure, you haven't produced a load across all of the muscle fibers, and as a result, you are not getting activation of these signaling pathways in every muscle fiber. And specifically not in even the biggest muscle fibers, because the way that you work is you start with the smallest motor units that are going to be able to do the exercise. And if you don't go to failure, only those small units get activated. And those aren't the ones that you're trying to activate by really pushing yourself to failure. As you get to failure, you have to recruit bigger and bigger motor units until you've recruited every motor unit within the muscle. And now every unit within the muscle has felt the load. As a result, you get the stimulus across every motor unit. That's true if you do blood flow restriction, if you're doing a low weight to failure, no matter how you do it, what you're trying to do is you're trying to get the load across each muscle fiber.
Yeah, it really is fascinating how our understanding, and this thanks to guys like you, this business of the whole molecular signaling, and I find it utterly fascinating because, of course, we're now learning the importance of the quality of the training. It's not just volume. It's not just, going and just doing the lifting a certain quantity of weight or a certain volume of training. And I had Martin Gibala on a while ago. We were talking about, the merits of high intensity interval training. And, you can achieve many of the same things just by hitting the road for a long period of time and putting in the hours or whatever. But of course, it's whatever it takes to get the message in, isn't it? I guess is how I'm interpreting this. And there's different ways of doing that.
Exactly. And so if you're training athletes, the idea is that what you want to do is you want to do the minimum amount of work that gets the signal with the least likelihood of injury. Mm. So if you've got, because everybody knows as you do greater and greater volume, it's towards the end when you pick up injuries because small muscles start to fatigue. Now you get into a problem where you're not strong through the core. You're not having some, and now you get a problem. You get a back problem. You get another issue. If you can achieve everything that your goal is within the musculature, And you can minimize injury because you're not doing the volume. That's ideal for an athlete. Because as a strength coach, my job was always to get a healthy, strong athlete to the field so that they could compete in their sport. If I know that, oh yeah, sure, if I use the shock method, I can do heavy plyometrics. If you survive the training, you're going to be super strong. But only 20%, 3% are going to survive that type of training. I'm not a very good strength coach, except if I start with a pool of a million kids, and yeah, all I need is 3 or 4 or 5 of them to be the world's best. But if I'm starting and I've got a team of 12 kids, if I only have 6 of them who are competitive by the season because I've crushed them in the weight room and I've made it so that they've got injuries to their back or to their complementary muscles, because while trying to target the big muscles, I've damaged all of their small muscles and all of their structure, I'm not a very good coach, and our team is not very successful. Whereas if I can get them healthy and I can get every single one of those kids healthy, stronger than they were and healthy, to the playing field for a competition, now we've got a great chance to win. And so that's the realization of training in a scientifically sound way, where you understand that I don't need to do five by five reps. I don't need to do, because there's no magic in it. What we're trying to do is we're trying to hit a signal. We can hit a signal in a myriad of different ways. What's going to be the safest and most effective at producing a healthy athlete?
No, absolutely. I completely agree. And of course, one has to think about the relevance of this to the real world. And of course, for those that are going to the gym 2-3 times a week, maybe not as significant, because going to the gym, of course, isn't necessarily just about training. It's a distraction from the real world. They might like to look at themselves in the mirror, that sort of thing. But for those of us that do work with athletes, and I'm one of those people, it's difficult to cram enough into a day. And they've got their skills training, they've got their conditioning. So learning how to maximize the quality of time spent in training, and you know, how one distributes time to all those other things, is going to make everyone's life easier. And as you say, you're also supporting concepts like recovery, reducing injury, and so on, which is why understanding the science behind this helps us make, you know, these decisions as to why we might choose certain training methods and so on. But going back, Keith, just back to nutrition again, I know you've mentioned at the beginning, and we've certainly mentioned with Lee Breen and Steve Phillips and Lane Norton and so on, we've talked about leucine and the importance of leucine threshold and so on. But I was reading some of your stuff, and you were getting into the importance of the leucine transporter, and there are factors that relate to that, and I haven't actually had that discussion with anyone, so I was wondering if you could just tell us about the leucine transporter and how that relates possibly to the timing of training and the timing of one's intake of protein, for example.
Right, so the leucine transporter is, there's a primary leucine transporter in skeletal muscle, it's a protein called LAT1. So we had done some work a long time ago that was only abstract form. Since then, Blake Rasmussen has done some studies in humans. We've done some studies in humans together with Stu. And what you can see is that after you do resistance exercise, there's a transient upswing in the amount of LAT1 that's present in both the mRNA and the protein. It's a really complex process how this happens. We're now studying it in mice that lack LAT1 in their skeletal muscle. We see that there's differences when they do feeding, when they do other things, because they're not able to get that leucine in, so they don't get the leucine trigger. So what happens is there's a tendency for their muscles to grow less effectively. The idea at some point is that there's this transient rise in the LAT1 transporter, and that is something that is up within the first 30 minutes to an hour and a half, and then it comes back down. As to whether that's in fact true, we haven't been able to definitively say, yes, the leucine transporter goes up at 30 minutes or an hour and a half. We've got data that goes up at an hour and a half, and then it seems like it's back down. And there's also a possibility that, like the glucose transporter, the leucine transporter translocates between the inside of the cell and the membrane. And so these studies are not easy to do, and it's very difficult to get the material and the skill needed to actually do that. But it's definitely something that we are looking at. We're looking at the possibility that the leucine transporter is translocating to the membrane from the inside of the muscle, going out to the membrane, specifically close to capillaries, and that's letting in more leucine. We've shown in a number of papers that when you do resistance exercise, there is more leucine in the muscle after resistance exercise, in the muscle that's worked, than in other muscles that haven't worked, or in the muscle beforehand. You get about a 25% increase in leucine. And that's without taking any protein in at all. So what that means is you're targeting any leucine within the blood is suddenly being targeted to the muscles that have worked. And that's only seen, you only see an increase in leucine within the first 90 minutes or so after resistance exercise. And again, that could be because you've got blood flow, but it also could be that you've got improved uptake of leucine. So the reason that we tell people that it is really good to take food in within the first 30 minutes after resistance exercise is because you've got the blood flow going to the muscle that you've just worked and potentially have this translocation of the leucine transporter, LAT1, to the membrane. And so those two things together would result in an increase in uptake of leucine, and that's what we see when we look in muscles of humans. So there's a paper by Biolo out of Bob Wolf's lab that showed that, yep, sure enough, after resistance exercise, you get an increase in amino acids in the active muscle, and specifically you get an increase in the branch chains, and leucine is one of the key aspects of that. They didn't look at mechanism. The work from Rasmussen says that there's more LAT1 total protein. Whether it's total protein or whether the proteins at the membrane now can transport leucine better, that's not been definitively shown by anybody. So it is something where you are getting better uptake of leucine. And we do think that this protein LAT1, which is the primary leucine transporter in muscle, is moving to the membrane, picking up more leucine than if you haven't done your exercise.
Great. Thank you, Keith. That was thorough. So I guess because we're kind of at the end of the podcast here, so there's a lot of things that we've covered here. Could you just give us a sort of a roundup with maybe more of a practical component then to, in your opinion, what would be the science-based recommendations for training then to optimize mTOR activation and strength gains? Sort of just, just a quick sum up there.
Yeah, so basically what you want to do to increase the activation of mTOR, your increase in muscle size and strength, is you want to do, you want to lift a heavy weight, because we know that from the animal studies where you can, if you activate all of the fibers, but it's lifting a heavy weight or a light weight, you get more strength and you get more muscle mass when you lift a heavy weight. And you want to lift that heavy weight to failure. Okay, so those two components are going to give you lifting the heavy weight, mTOR activity is proportional to the weight across the muscle, and lifting it to failure means that you get that heavy weight across all of the fibers. Now you get mTOR activation in all of the fibers within the muscle. So basically your goal, if you're strength training, is to lift the heavy weight to failure. And so when we say that, basically, it's not you do one or two repetitions because that's positive failure because you haven't been able to lift the weight. That's not it necessarily what we're looking at. What we're looking at is something where you're going to get to something like your 6 to 8 rep maximum weight. So you get 100% of your 6 to 8 rep maximum and you lift it 6 to 8 times if you're in a supported situation and you can get to failure, positive and negative failure. If you're doing rapid movements, ballistic movements that you have small muscles are important and you can't get to failure, you're going to have to do multiple sets. If you're supported and you can get to failure in one set's enough, because what you're doing is using that volume. If you don't get to failure in one set, now by adding more volume, you get more mTOR activation, you get more protein synthesis. So if you can get to failure in one set, one set's enough. Lift a heavy weight, get to failure. If you can't get to failure in one set because other muscles other than target muscles are going to fail before the target muscles, now you have to do multiple sets and get closer and closer to failure at each set. And so if you do that, and then you time your nutrition so that it's going to be the way that, you know, if you're a weight class athlete, you time your training around your nutrition. Your biggest amino acid meal is your dinner. So what we try for weight class athletes, go ahead and lift from about 5 or 5:30 till dinner time. Finish up, go straight to dinner. Eat your dinner that's going to have a higher protein content anyway. Now you don't have to add a special meal in. If you're not a weight class athlete and you're trying to really gain mass, okay, eat within the first, or take in 20 grams, 0.25 grams of protein per kilogram body weight. And now you're going to do that within the first 30 minutes. And then three or so hours later, you can do another meal, and you can consecutively do it. Every 3 to 4 hours, you're going to want to increase, or you're going to want to take in a protein source. Doing those two things, the heavy weight to failure, that's going to activate mTOR mechanically. The amino acids coming in simultaneously are going to move mTOR to its activator. The resistance exercise to failure is move the inhibitor away. Now you get maximal activation of mTOR. Now you're going to get maximal growth. It's not going to be your optimal power. If you're going to do optimal power, you're going to have to do other things. But this is going to maximize the size and strength of the muscle.
Fantastic. That was excellent, Keith. We managed to get through almost an entire PhD in 45 to 50-odd minutes there. I know a lot of folks are going to want to listen to that one again and again. So full of useful information. But if they do want to learn more about your work and studies, what's sort of the best way to find out more about you and your work? Your website, I believe, is it Muscle Science?
No, well, so Muscle Science is the Twitter feed.
Yeah.
The lab is the Functional Molecular Biology Lab, so it's fmblab.com. If they're relatively new to the molecular biology, I would encourage them to go to the GSSI website. Mm. So gssiweb.com, and then you can go to the Sports Science Exchanges. Those are a little bit more for a coach-athlete type of thing where there's molecular biology, but it's not really in-depth molecular biology. If those things are relatively straightforward, they have a handle on molecular biology. We've got a number of reviews that have come out over the last little while talking about mTOR and exercise, mTOR and resistance exercise, and then concurrent training. And those you can find just by at PubMed, just with a quick search there. And those are most of those. I think all of those are open access. Yeah. If they aren't, yeah, people feel free to email me, and I can send them the papers that aren't open access. But most of those papers are going to be open access.
Yeah, no, there's a lot. I did find a lot, and I have a lot of my students using a lot of your papers that are pretty freely available. So anyway, look, thank you so much for your time. It's been great to have you on board here to share all your great knowledge on this stuff. I know that, you know, as the years go by, we'll just keep learning more and more and more, and it'll be interesting to see where all of this goes. But that concludes the end of this We Do Science podcast. My name is Laurel Barrick. You can learn more about us at guruperformance.com.